You're listening to The Profile.
Welcome to The Profile podcast. God calls us to use our influence to share his love and goodness. For some, this is in leadership. I'm Andy Peck, and for the past 19 years, I've been interviewing Christians to find out how to lead better. Taking the initiative isn't always easy, so I hope you'll benefit from this latest conversation. The Profile podcast is brought to you by Premier Christianity magazine. Subscribe today and get full online access and the print magazine every month at premierchristianity.com. How is your diet? Do you find yourself with food cravings maybe at 9 o'clock at night when you're watching TV or get in from a leadership meeting a bit later? When did you last exercise? And I'm not talking about walking from the car to your office. In a healthy food conscious society, many are realizing that to some extent, we are what we eat. And it may be that your mood, outlook, and life as a leader is more affected by your diet than you realize. Leadership is a marathon, not a sprint, and regular exercise can help you stay healthy and able to do the long hours sometimes required. Jesus says we're to love the Lord with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The strength part suggesting we honor God with our body. And without being excessive, some leaders have found that they're not functioning effectively because of diets high in the wrong kind of things. So I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Shola Oladipo, who is a registered dietitian and CEO of Food for Purpose, a non-profit organization that delivers nutritional health and lifestyle interventions for global majority communities at risk of and living with chronic illness. Her PhD research addressed the potential role of Black majority church leaders in influencing health behaviors and inequalities in the Black community. So welcome, Shola, to the Leadership Show.
Thank you so much, Andy. It's good to be here.
I know you're a regular on Premier, but it's great to have you on this section of Premier looking at leadership. How did you become a dietitian, first of all, Shola?
Oh, Andy, it's such an interesting story. So I remember it was way back in 1991, I had my first son, and I was holding him, and I just happened to be in front of a mirror, Andy. Basically, I saw this rather large lady carrying a baby that I recognized, but I didn't recognize that woman. It was actually me. And what happened is I'd gone from, I don't know, something like 13 stones, like 83 kilos, and my weight had almost doubled. And literally that was over a period of about 2 to 3 years. And it just happened insidiously. I was shocked, went to the doctors, and spoke to a lovely gentleman, gave me about 3 minutes of his time, didn't even weigh me or, you know, do any measurements, mumbled something under his breath about not eating bread and rice, gave me a resource, which people call them diet sheets or, you know, resource, a self-help sheet, which looked as though it'd been photocopied like a million times. And that was it. Went home, cried my eyes out. And my husband said to me, do you know, you could do something. Why don't you change this? You know, what, instead of crying, why don't you do something about it? So I enrolled to become a dietitian. And 20 something years later, I'm still here. And trying to make a difference.
Brilliant, Shola. I said in my introduction, Shola, that we're in a health food conscious society. But although there is more material around and phone apps to assist us, do you still think there's a lot of ignorance? And perhaps this includes Christians and leadership?
Oh, Andy, do you know, I think it's fair to say that we are somewhat swamped, aren't we, with in quotes, knowledge that it's coming thick and fast, you know, the online apps and portals. And I think a lot of the time we're seeing that everyone now is a kind of a homemade expert when it comes to nutrition. And therefore, we're running the risk of everyone in the church leaders, everybody running with a fragment of the truth, but it's not quite the full picture. And much is based on pseudoscience, a mixture of people's lived experience, you know, their personal health journey, of course, culture. And then a lot of my research shows that this is also aligned with biblical culture, and that, you know, mix that all up together, we have something that's not quite the real truth. And therefore, I do feel, with all, you know, due respect and love for my colleagues as church leaders, that yes, we are at risk. And it's this overload of knowledge and just lack of the real truth, but lots of fragments of it.
Sure. Shola, some years ago in my work as a pastor, I used to find it very difficult to concentrate when chatting with people one-on-one in the afternoon. I came across an article suggesting that too many carbs make you sleepy and I should eat some protein for lunch. So it had an almost instant cure. And I guess my first introduction into the benefits of good nutrition was that situation. Now, you could question whether that was good advice or not. But maybe you could say a little bit about diet and mood and concentration as it all fits together.
Yeah, interesting. There is something, I won't say there's something, there's a lot of studies out there now actually showing that balance is really important. So indeed, too much carbs means, you know, a lack of other nutrients will actually make us sluggish because that is an imbalance. And there are lots of studies now, loads that show that diet affects our alertness, our ability to focus and concentrate. And it's hard to say whether it was just protein, you know, without a full nutritional assessment, it's hard to pinpoint what the thing could be. But we definitely know that these heavy meals during the day can actually make us sluggish because your body is working really hard to package all of that and your blood glucose levels are rising. We get what we call after eating this postprandial slump. And indeed, having a more balanced meal, so not having too much carb, having more vegetables and moderate amounts of protein can actually help. What we do also know that, you know, that slump, that kind of tiredness and lack of concentration can be caused by things like low iron levels. So if iron levels are low, we feel really tired. Other minerals like zinc also can, you know, low levels can affect. And of course, vitamin D. A lot of the time we talk about vitamin D, the sunshine vitamin, but when we don't have enough, we do actually feel tired, quite sluggish, and a condition that's almost close to feeling quite withdrawn and depressed. And then, of course, there's lack of fluid. We now know, we've known for a while, that if we're not well hydrated, we also struggle to concentrate and can feel quite lethargic. So there's lots going on. And there really is something about diet affecting the way we perform, as well as affecting our mood.
Shola, perhaps you say something about sugar. Again, I've seen various comments. Obviously, there's the diabetic issue with sugar and being in many people in a pre-diabetic or diabetic state without knowing it would seem within the UK, certainly. And there's a lot of unseen sugar in many processed foods. So perhaps you could say a little bit about that.
Yes. I think it's interesting that we talk about, you know, sort of unseen and hidden sugar. And I have to be fair to the labeling authorities, as it were, in the UK. And it is a kind of unseen because we don't realize it, but actually we should actually be reading labels, Andy, with processed foods, and we'll just see how much sugar is there. And we need to make sure when we're reading labels that it isn't hidden, because a lot of the time when sugar is the first, second or third ingredient, we know that it's high in sugar, even though it seems like a food that shouldn't be high in sugar. So we know in the UK particular that we're eating far too much sugar. And, you know, sugar occurs in several, you know, different forms. I think the relation between sugar and diabetes is an interesting one. So a lot of the time people feel that, you know, eating too much sugar causes diabetes, which isn't actually the case. So it's the extra calories from sugar that lead to weight gain. And the weight gain is what leads to the risk of type 2 diabetes. And obviously, you know, this can cause other problems, dental problems, fatty liver, worsening inflammatory conditions. In the UK, we're eating 4 or 5 times the recommended daily amount. Well, it isn't a recommended, it's kind of the guidance, which for adults is about, Andy, 5 teaspoons a day in everything that we have. The major sources in the UK are things like sugary drinks, fruit juices, cakes, biscuits, desserts, sweets and spreads. And yes, can I say, even natural sources. And I think sometimes I find that a lot of people get confused about natural sources. So we have what we call free sugars, which are things, sugars that are added to, you know, to things like biscuits and fizzy drinks. But also free sugars are found naturally in fruit juices, purees, fruit purees, honey and syrup. So even though they're God's natural sugar, they still are what we call free sugars and will have, you know, the same effect in terms of causing obesity, affecting our teeth. So we really do need to manage the amount of sugar we're eating and almost retrain our taste buds. And it's about going back to basics again and reteaching our taste buds, because a lot of the time we don't even notice from our taste buds that it's actually there.
Right. No, that's really helpful, Shirley. And you mentioned drink earlier on, and maybe I was dehydrated and that was causing me to be sleepy. But in terms of how much we drink, the figure of 2 liters has been banded around. Is that a wise figure to go by?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? For all of my career, we've been going around this 1.5 to 2 liters. 2 liters is a heck of a lot if you're, I don't know, you know, 5'2" and very slight. So I think we should really be thinking about trying to have at least a minimum of 5 to 6 glasses of fluid a day. Not everyone will reach 2 liters. And Andy, what I prefer to get people to do is to try and drink at least a minimum of 5 glasses of fluid a day, or small bottles. But what I like people to do is to do the wee check. And the wee check is really easy. It's something that we do naturally. We go to wee. Check the colour of your wee. If your wee is dark and sometimes, you know, quite concentrated, then you're not drinking enough. When you wee, it should be a really light straw colour. And that often shows that you are drinking enough. So if you're not sure, then, you know, do the wee check. A lot of people I know are struggling to get 2 liters in. They're running to the loo all the time, and actually they are well hydrated. So the 2 liters is very, very general. I think a lot of people are okay with 1.5 liters. And some people, as I said, because they're smaller, are even fine with less. But I think it's important for us to understand that we also find, you know, fluid, water in some of our foods. So, you know, some of the foods that we eat, some of the vegetables, particularly salad vegetables, are quite high in water as well. And to be careful with caffeinated drinks. So they do count as our fluid quota, as it were. But things like tea, coffee and chocolate obviously contain caffeine, which is a stimulant and can affect us, particularly as leaders. It can make us, you know, quite restless, can give headaches, dizziness, heart palpitations, and of course can cause us to run to the loo because they have a diuretic effect. So actually can cause, you know, a vicious cycle where you're running to pee and then you need to drink again, because caffeinated drinks do actually make us want to go and pass urine.
So moving, I guess, to applying all this to Christians in leadership, I mean, any leader faces stressful times. Leading an organization can include unexpected crises. We have interpersonal conflict to negotiate. And there can be a temptation to seek solace in comfort foods. I guess we would all admit that. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, and we are in really stressful times, and my heart goes out to all leaders, particularly church leaders, but anyone who's in that leadership position. And we are seeing that stress eating is common in leaders, and it's usually born out of this, you know, hormonal an imbalance. So the stress hormones are raised. And they often initially cause our appetite to actually shut down. So initially when we're in a position of stress, we don't actually feel too much hunger. But because those stress hormones are persistently high, so things like cortisol, persistently high, we find ourselves craving often sugary foods. So, you know, cakes, biscuits, high carbohydrate foods. And they tend to be refined foods. And we, you know, eat them. They make us feel great momentarily. So blood glucose spikes, you feel great, but then blood glucose crashes and then we feel awful again. And do you know what I'm finding, Andy, is with that comes a lot of hidden eating. So a lot of leaders who are stressed are secret eaters. So this cycle is happening secretly. They're undergoing what we call disordered eating, which can lead to, you know, shame. And unhealthy addictions to particular types of food. And there is really something about, you know, supporting our leaders to counter this kind of stress by, you know, acknowledging that our Christian leaders do go through this. We're human, you know, we're not superhuman beings. And there's something about creating spaces for our leaders to have these conversations. Exercise can actually really help. And I don't mean running around a gym. Just going for a walk can really help to manage those cortisol levels, and also social support. You know, we need to put our arms around our leaders as well, and they need social support to manage that stress that can lead to stress eating and disordered eating.
Shola, your research looked at how church leaders in black majority churches can be role models. I'm just interested if you could summarize a lot of work, I'm sure, what you actually found.
Yeah, so in the last 5 years of my life, I've spent myself researching the health behaviours and opinions of black church leaders. And basically, health inequalities tend to be more common in black communities. So you spoke earlier about diabetes. It tends to be higher in black communities than our non-black counterparts. And we also have this, you know, kind of narrative that, you know, black people are hard to reach. And as a healthcare professional myself and a church leader, married to a church leader, we found that we're not hard to reach. A lot of black people are in church. And even though, you know, church attendance is decreasing in the UK, there's some interesting data that shows that the black church is on the increase. So therefore, we developed church-based interventions. And my study has shown that actually black majority church leaders are welcoming of what we call church-based health interventions. So people can run church-based programs that increase physical activity, that manage sugar, increase fiber, manage fat and salt, and, you know, look out for things like fluid and this kind of holistic health that's Bible-based. And leaders have been found to be great role models. And actually, churches are keen to, you know, model what their leaders do. So if leaders will take up these healthy behaviours, talk about it at the pulpit, welcome these, my study has shown that there's a potential for our health to improve, and perhaps less of a reliance on the NHS and some of the health services. Also, we found that, you know, leaders found that we see our bodies as a spirit, soul, and body. And we notice that a lot of the time, Andy, we emphasize on the spirit. So we pray a lot. We do lots of positive confessions. We're now recognizing, so, you know, the soul, the sort of mental well-being, we're recognizing that, but we're leaving the vehicle. So we're not looking after the body, and our bodies are our only legal tender. We have to be here on earth. So if we're not looking after it, then really all of that spiritual exercise isn't going to do us too much. So it actually showed in general that the black majority church and black majority church leaders are a great way of introducing health to a community that may not go to the doctors or may not engage with health programs, particularly because they're not culturally tailored. So in a nutshell, a massive nutshell.
Sure, no. And you could you expand that to all church leaders, some of the things that you found?
Yes, indeed. And I think that's the exciting part, that this has been a pilot, as it were. But actually, we have noted in the US that church-based health interventions are massive. Of course, because in the US, they don't have the NHS. We're really blessed to have the NHS in the UK. And therefore, the church has become an arena that people come into for health interventions because they're free and because healthcare has to be paid for. So definitely, the data is showing that this can be extrapolated to other faith environments where we know people congregate. But because obviously I'm a healthcare professional, not just for Christians, we know that this model can also work in other cultures where faith attendance is high. And it's about, you know, having a healthy nation. So the exciting thing is, yes, this can definitely be extrapolated, and the transferability across other groups is, the potential is great.
Well, that's great to hear. The saying is that you can't out-exercise a poor diet. Exercise is a valuable part of taking care of ourselves. You've always mentioned, you know, the value of going for a walk and that kind of stuff. But would you, what would you say to Christian leaders, some of whom have pretty sedentary lives? You know, they're sat at a laptop a lot of the time, or even going to visit people is, you know, again, a very sedentary business. What would you say about the importance of exercise?
Yes, indeed. Do you know, Andy, I'm a bit cheeky and always joke about this and say, you know, a lot of us as Christian leaders, we talk so much about walking in the spirit, don't we, in Galatians 5.
Yeah.
But we need to perhaps emphasize walking in the physical as well.
Yes.
And also, you know, it's interesting. If we just look at Jesus as our model for just a moment, we always, you know, want to be like Jesus and emulating Jesus. And I think one thing is noticing that Jesus tended to walk almost everywhere. If he wasn't on a boat or on a donkey, Jesus was walking. And I think there's something about encouraging us, particularly as leaders, to move more. And I, do you know, Andy, I think it's very wrong for us to assume that when people aren't moving, that they're lazy. So a lot of our leaders are actually working hard. They're not actually lazy. However, without the movement, the physical movement, it's affecting our health. So in their busyness, like, you know, you talked about home visits and, you know, being in church and getting a lot of things done. Our leaders really do need to walk more or move more. So if you're in an office right now and you're sitting, take your phone call standing. Try, the government guidance recommends something like 30 minutes a day, three times a week. If you can't do that, that can look, you know, really insurmountable. How about 11 minutes a day? So there's new data showing that 11 minutes every day can make a difference. Walking on the spot, sitting on a chair, if your mobility is poor, sitting on a chair and, you know, doing chair walking. There are lots of resources to support our leaders. How about dancing and moving more, you know, praising the Lord and dancing like David did, prayer walks. But there is something really for our leaders about moving more and, you know, gradually increasing and doing it regularly.
And certainly if you are doing nothing present, then a minutes a day is going to be massive. And, you know, people can feel intimidated. Oh boy, I can't become an athlete or whatever.
Yeah.
But just starting with something can actually improve things. And of course, there's an endorphin benefit of exercise too.
Yes, absolutely. And that endorphin, you know, I talked about that kind of sugar rush that makes you feel good. The endorphins make you feel even better.
Yeah, yeah. Naturally occurring drugs, as it were, within our bodies.
Indeed. Especially made by God, endorphins.
Indeed. Presumably, Shola, the people coming to you for help are people who are ill or struggling with some health kind of benefit. Do you have people who come for just for general advice as well?
Yes, but do you know what, Andy? We go to them. So a large focus of our work is actually what we call prevention.
Okay.
So, you know, it is about prevention. It is about recognizing, I spoke earlier about certain communities have a higher propensity towards what we call avoidable chronic illness. So obesity is avoidable, type 2 diabetes is avoidable. So we go to them. So we are commissioned by local authorities. We do a lot of work in South London. We're commissioned by local councils and public health. And we go to the church leaders. We come knocking on your doors. We're paid by the government to do this. So, you know, we appeal to our leaders to open your doors. It's free. You know, it's a blessing. And it's not just for people who already have a condition. We want to reach people before they do, because we know once the condition is set in, a lot of the time it's harder to allay those effects in later life. So we want to catch them before. It's so important that we're catching diabetes before, pre-diabetes before, you know, before people are getting heavy. So you don't have to be sick or, you know, unwell. Let's do it now.
And there seems to be a connection between income levels and capacity to eat healthily. Would that sometimes be a hindrance to people if they don't have the disposable income to buy the better foods?
Do you know, Andy, if you'd asked me this, I don't know, 5 years ago, I would have said, oh, it's a myth. You know, it's not expensive to eat healthier. Now I believe it is just expensive to eat, full stop. Right. Yes. The cost of living has made it ridiculously difficult for more of the majority of the public to eat healthily. I still think that there are certainly ways that people can eat healthily, but everything now is seems to be unnecessarily expensive. But at Food for Purpose, we're real advocates for supporting people to make use of something like the church community. So as churches, we could shop as cooperatives and therefore make use of, you know, farmers markets, buying food in bulk and supporting people in terms of storage. So there is a sort of a way around it. And we try to raise this awareness in churches.
Shola, how would people get in touch with you if they want to hear more about your work?
Yeah, so our website is www.foodforpurpose.org, and we've got lots of resources. Just hit us up if you have anything you want to know. Please do email, contact us as an email address, but also you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm sharing a lot more of my research in the next few months, and I am just Shola Oladipo on LinkedIn.
Well, we've dipped our toe into a very important topic, but you've given some wise thoughts and insights, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was super to chat to Dr. Shola Oladipo. And surname is spelled O-L-A-D-I-P-O. I hope you found the conversation of value as you seek to honor God with your body. Now, it's hard to pitch. Some of you perhaps know an awful lot about this kind of area, and perhaps others less so. But certainly making changes to diet or exercise is not easy, but certainly possible, and many leaders have found that dietary change and an increase in exercise has made all the difference. So if you know that that's you, why not start now? This is Andy Peck, thanking you for your company and knowing that God will equip you for his work in the days ahead. Bye for now.
The Leadership Show with Andy Peck. To get in touch, email andy.peck@premier.org.uk.
Been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.